Doot, 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 doot. I can't remember exactly how that song goes because I'm not a musician, but I know that when I did the video with the buffalo, that I got the buffalo to come close because I was out there kind of like trying to hum the song poorly, and the buffalo didn't exactly know how it went. And so then I'm out there kind of going, doot, 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 doot. And then they're all kind of coming in, and what is up with this guy? I mean, I was the most interesting thing to walk by the field that day.
Hey, George, let's go look at the freak show.
What the hell is that guy doing? And so next thing you know, they're all like up against the fence looking at me, and I'm videoing them. And then, of course, then I put Jimmy's music in on top of that, you know, when I'm editing it later, and which is the music I'm trying to hum along. So this morning I get this thing, and somebody has basically made a video of themselves doing, you know, they're making some yogurt. They're just kind of doing their you know, day-to-day homesteadish kind of thing, and they got the laptop open while they're doing their work, and it's playing. So the guy is sitting there relaxing, and the woman's like, you know, it looks like she's sterilizing some mason jars for some yogurt, and they're watching that video with the buffalo. And it's like, we're all a bunch of fucking weirdos. And it's like, and of course, part of the message is we're all just the same, and we're all a bunch of fucking weirdos. And so,
true, but at least they were, you know, messing with a dairy product while they were watching the video. You know, they had to get inspired.
I don't know how that ties in, but
well, with the buffalo, you know.
The important thing to me
I've
was...
I've never milked a buffalo, but you never know. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, let us know how that works out for you. First, you gotta catch them. Yeah, sure. Then you gotta make sure that it's the female.
Oh yeah, I thought it was a girl.
Awkward. So then the guy is like, so then they're like, you know, I don't know, they're just doing that, just, you know, we're making some yogurt kind of a thing, and the guy's like, you know, and it's like, so then, but then the guy's like really kind of tuning into the music, and he's like, who made this music? It's like, man, he's one of us. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we are all a bunch of fucking weirdos. We're all just the same, aren't we? So he's like kind of getting a little philosophical. And I'm thinking, I'm thinking like, because it's like he videos out the window, and they're in like, it looks like it's a tiny house. And he, you know, points the camera out the window, and it's like, you know, definitely rural. And so I don't know. I just thought it was cool.
That is nice.
I just thought it was really cool. So I posted it out at Permies. We'll see what the feedback is. I thought it was a good.
Oh, time. That'll be cool to see. Yeah.
So we're doing Sepulter's Permaculture, cultivating mushrooms. This is the very beginning of chapter 4. I got to tell you, I sat down to read. We marked out a section that we would both read, to do this podcast about, and it took me a long time because I would read something, and it would strike me as so profound, my mind would start wandering off into all kinds of crazy directions, and then I'd realize, oh shit, I'm supposed to be reading this book. But it's like, you know, of course, the big thing here, I think. To me, the most important thing here is the symbiotic relationship between the plants and the fungus, and how important that is. And then then my mind starts to wander off into the symbiotic relationship between individual people, between people and plants, between people and funguses, between funguses and everything. And I don't know. My mind just keeps going off about how. And then I remember this. I had this idea for a while. I was, in fact, I went out and I got the domain name simbiculture.com. Ooh. With the idea of like, well, if permaculture gets taken over to mean hearts, flowers, and rainbows, then my plan B is simbiculture. And I kind of thought that it's like, you know, a form of agriculture based on the symbiotic relationships between everything. And then, you know, to optimize those symbiotic relationships for the benefit of my own laziness, and my own goals, kind of a thing. But I do think that permaculture is, you know, far better, and I'm sticking to permaculture for now.
It kind of already has sort of a base of fans, so that's a good thing to do.
and it's got a much bigger message, and I think as long as we're allowed to have, you know, different schools of thought in the world of permaculture, then I'm I'm in.
Right.
But as soon as, but every once in a while we get this, you know, crowd that comes up and says, like, no, this is the only way we can do permaculture, and as part of it, we have to do, you know, a little bit, you have to dance with your left leg this way and stretch your right arm out that way. And
that crowd exists in every group. And you just sort of have to keep doing what you're doing, and hopefully you're the change that everyone affects or likes to step into, you know.
Right.
I just stepped into some change here.
I do seem to get a lot of that where people are kind of like, hey, this person over there was saying there's only one way of permaculture, and then basically what they want is that they want to, like, have me come in and crush that person or something.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, really. Say, well, it's like, I think what happens is people really want to, like, it's their idea that this is the way things should be, and then they want all these people to follow them, and then they start doing things that are very unfortunate, and that's, you know, it's a sad state of affairs, but that's the way it works.
I think it's even more basic than that. I think what it is that people have been trained as a form of communication to speak in absolutes when it's really their opinion. And then it's like, you know, and I think once we start to speak in absolutes, then it like shuts out all of the things and all other things, everybody has to be this particular way, then it's like, okay, that's the beginning of how everything falls apart. Whereas if we speak in, like, this is my opinion, and this is my position, and this is, you know, then we start to get into this space of, like, a very resilient form of communication.
Right.
And it's allowing other people to have different positions, and I think that that's going to be far healthier. So, so it's like more of a form of communication is the problem that I believe that we're seeing when we start going down that road. But all right, we're wandering off topic. So you see how I read a little bit in this chapter, and next thing you know, I'm like way off topic, faster than my own mind.
That's my problem, too. Any book I read, it takes me 5 times as long to get through it than my wife, because she just reads it, and I just sit there and, like, stew over it constantly.
So I think anybody reading this book might have a hard time reading this chapter just because it's, like, so profound and full of, like, little things. It's like, and that so applies to life. Next thing you know, you're, like, staring up at the clouds for, like, you know, half an hour.
Right.
And realize, oh, shit, that's right, I'm trying to read this book.
Right.
All right. Yes, here we go. Cultivating Mushrooms, Chapter 4. Here's what I've marked out in the very first paragraph. Mushrooms were one of my most important sources of income in the 80s. However, the atomic disaster in Chernobyl in 1986 suddenly changed the situation. Despite the fact that our mushrooms were obviously not contaminated, overnight it became impossible to sell them. This hard economical blow caused me a number of sleepless nights. In hindsight, it does, however, make clear what the consequences of extreme specialization for a business can be. All right. I'm sorry, I'm confused. How is it that the Chernobyl event made it so people didn't want to buy Sepp's mushrooms?
Well, it's the mushrooms suck up. What do they call it? Was it micro remediation? It actually has the ability to suck toxins out of the environment. And so what happens is they were probably because I haven't read up on it, but you know. Worried about the fact that this stuff may have actually contaminated all the mushrooms. And now I would like to know what made them so obviously not contaminated. You know what I mean? Like, did the other ones start to glow? I mean, I have no idea what that was, but yeah, they do suck toxins out of the environment, so it could be a problem.
Okay, that's true. And I want to just nudge a slight correction. So you said micro remediation.
I meant micro.
Mico, there you go. Yes, okay. Sorry, little thorn got caught in my side there.
These are really little mushrooms.
And it solves really small problems. Mm-hmm. So, I do agree that it's possible. So it's like mushrooms are pretty famous for being able to, and they're using micro-remediation a lot. So like you've got a bunch of soil or whatever, and it's loaded with toxic gick. It's amazing how mushrooms, especially oyster mushrooms, can be put in there to kind of, you know, help. They can do a really amazing stuff at fixing problems. And so then, but they'll be able to pull certain toxins out of the soil and break them down into non-toxic substances.
Right.
But there are some things, like heavy metals, that they can't break down. And then, of course, metals can have a radioactive element. And then I think even just certain, you know, stuff that's naturally radioactive, it can pull that out too. But then all that radioactive gobbledygook is in the mushroom. So, like, you know, one of the solutions is like, okay, we've got all these heavy metals in the soil. We're going to try and, you know, fix this soil. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to plant a whole bunch of mushrooms. They're going to suck up all those heavy metals. Then we need to go and cut off all the fruiting bodies and haul them away because now they're loaded with heavy metals.
Right, and let's just put them somewhere and hope it doesn't, eke out.
Right, and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's somebody who's like, you know, hey, we're buying heavy metals.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Bring them over here.
Yeah,
well, we'll dry them out, set them on fire.
We use them as a food additive.
Yeah, I don't. Yuck. But and Sepp's going to go into that a little bit here in a moment. But before I forget, I think it's important to point out that, you know, along these lines, when I first saw Paul Stamets speak, and at that point I'd I'd been buying Paul Stamets' stuff, and I'd, you know, been reading his stuff and everything. But the first time I ever heard him speak, he had four ways that he's currently saving the world.
Right.
And so he had this, you know, rather large cape.
And was he really wearing a cape?
He wasn't wearing a cape. He was wearing a hat made out of fungus, though.
You had me there for a second. Okay.
Yeah. And so, and of course, I've got my own little beef with the Paul Stamets camp right now, but that's now 4 years old. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I have to admit that the guy is doing amazing stuff. But let's see if I can remember the four things. So one is exactly what we're talking about. There's a project where there's like four piles of toxic gick, and one of them's the control. One of them, Paul Stamets is going to do his thing, and then two more are going to be other companies that are going to try and come in and do their thing. And let's point out for a moment that we're talking about companies here. Paul Stamets has a company, a corporation, and when people are out there saying "down with the corporation," I mean, are they saying that, you know, down with Paul Stamets' work here? So I think it's important to say down with bad guys, not down with corporations.
Right.
So, and then of course, out of these four piles, three of them remained toxic, and Paul Stamets' pile actually started sprouting a ton of weeds. Yeah, and it's like it's a big weed pile. So basically, his micro remediation is doing the trick. Is working. So that's one. Number two is where he, curing cancer. He's got some fungals, and not only cancer, but like several different serious ailments, different kinds of funguses that he's come up that are naturally occurring in nature that are basically a form of herbalism. Eat these, and your serious diseases go away, or at least, you know, maybe not go away, but it helps. It makes a difference.
Right.
Another one was the whole thing about, and this is the one for which he's gotten the most death threats and the scary things happening to him, has to do with how he's come up with an insecticide of funguses. And basically it's like it's a naturally occurring thing. And so it's like ants come along and they go, this fungus is delicious. And they're eating it and chomping it. And next thing you know, they die and fungus grows out of the ants. So if you've got carpenter ants eating your home, then you put a little bit of this out, and then you don't have that problem anymore.
Right, and the death threats are real.
Absolutely.
I think, from the pesticide people, the people that spray your house.
Right, because this would seriously fuck up their industry.
Oh yeah.
You know, and so these guys that have been making serious bank for years, you know, suddenly, you know, they're not going to be making bank. So anyway, my impression is that in order for him to get this stuff to market, it sounds like he is, like the government is just fighting him tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, is it really the government?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it is, and I think it's real that we know who actually runs the government. But anyway, that's my point of view.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't talk about mushrooms without mentioning Paul Stamets. I mean, the guy is amazing with what he does. And I've heard a podcast where he talked about this whole thing, including his fear that he would get attacked by this industry. And now you're saying it's really happened, because this podcast was from a couple of years ago.
So I've talked to some people that told me some stories.
Wow.
And about what had happened, and it's like, oh fuck. I mean, it sounds like it's gone beyond threats.
Right.
There's been attempts.
Well, he also had the way to use funguses to clean up the oil spills.
Yes.
And when it was all done, it was completely innocuous materials. The fungus would have actually made the area more fertile.
Right. Absolutely. Yep.
So, man.
Yeah. Is that four? Is that number four? I don't know if I can remember all the different things, but it does seem to me like he's coming up with just a ton of stuff.
Right.
that's really saving the world. It's really, really amazing stuff, and it's like he's just bonkers about finding this stuff. And of course, you know, there's other people out there that are also doing things, and I've run into a couple of other people that are like that I trust that are really smart people, and I better not mention their names, who have said, I hate that guy. He's doing it all wrong. It's all backwards.
Oh, wow.
And I tried to ask, get more information about it, and basically it turns out that I'm too stupid to understand why. But I don't fully understand that, but I do know that I got burned by his organization, and I'm bitter about it. But at the same time, it's like, geez, the guy's doing good stuff.
Right.
Even I'm still angry.
Have you ever read his book, Mycelium Running?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was taking so many notes in the foreword, it was ridiculous. The thing is just packed full of good information. But there's always two sides of every coin. Like, you know, there was this one podcast about soils, and everybody was arguing on that one. You know, so it could probably work both ways. So who knows?
Well, and like soil scientists come in so many different flavors.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and there are, well, anyway, that, I mean, it gets complicated and rich, and yeah.
Yeah. At least we're having that discussion.
And it's not like it's not like so much that there's two sides. It's like, you know, everybody's kind of a complicated individual.
Right.
And it does seem to me like with Paul Stamets, so often a lot of the stuff that you see is like, you know, I think the second time I saw him speak, he had it was six things. He'd upped it to six things that he's doing to save the world, and the audience was probably about 700 people.
Wow.
And so if he's, you know, I mean, like when he's just one guy standing up in front of the room and he's going to talk for 50 minutes, then it's kind of like you're not going to get a real thorough picture of the guy. And basically the thing, you know, I don't want to get too much into the thing I'm mad about, but he sent me a lovely letter and a care package and said, let's have Fungi Perfect Eye and permies.com like get married and have children, and we're going to, so I basically proposed this idea of the, you know, he's like yeah, that is awesome, let's do it, let's move forward. I'm going to turn it over to this person, one of my employees here, who's going to facilitate all of that. And then it's like I went out and I did all my work. I set it all up. I promoted it and everything. And then these other people started, you know, and I called up to say, okay, I did this part, and now I'm ready for you guys to do your part. And then people are like, what? We're not doing that.
It's hard to find good help these days.
And I said, well, you know, Paul Stamets said yeah. Then this person was saying yeah. Okay, Paul told me to do this with you. And so it's like, and they're like, you know, well, I'm the person who fixes all the crazy things that Paul Stamets does. And so we're not doing that. And yeah, I understand that you already went and did all the promotion, and you went and spent all this money, and you did all these other things and everything. But I don't really care. And it's kind of like, really? This is the way you're going
to
play it?
I think we're back to why everybody like waits for a signed contract, and why contracts are so incredibly detailed and painful. And
yeah. Right. You know, and at the same time, all the best and most awesome things that I've ever done in all of my life, there was no contract at all.
I hear you. I don't personally do it myself, but yeah.
And all of the things that went totally south and sour and crazy had like this incredibly detailed contract to keep it from going crazy. And it's like, you know, so this has kind of been this bizarre pattern. And so I, you know, I kind of feel a little bit like I like going in, and instead of having a contract, I like testing the waters.
Right.
You know, and like, okay, let's do a small thing, and then we'll do a little bit bigger thing. And then after we've done six or seven things, let's do a bigger thing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And, you know, that kind of thing.
That's
so,
good old-fashioned contracts, you know, the handshake, and I look you straight in the eye, and I know what's going on here.
But you're right. I mean, basically, so many people are kind of like, oh, you got to have all these contracts. These are people that have been burned, right?
Uh-huh.
And so it's a very complicated space, and not what this podcast is really about.
Well, let's move on.
And we've got ourselves out in the weeds again. All right. Further down this page, page 137. How many pages is this book? Because I think we're getting further along.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to...
Readable pages prior to the index. There's a concluding thoughts. It goes to 219.
So there's projects. Does it go to? Oh, okay. So we're on
217.
Okay, so, oh, good. We're probably about two thirds of the way through.
Yep.
Awesome.
Getting there. Yep.
All right. Further down the page, many fungi also develop mycorrhizae and form symbiotic associations with plants. The fungus's hyphae colonize the ends of the plant's roots, take over a part of the plant's nutrition, and help the plant to absorb water and mineral nutrients. So, I, you know what? I think that paragraph right there is something that 95% of all gardeners just cannot wrap their heads around. They don't know that it exists, or they've been told this and they don't believe it.
Or it's just so far outside of your brain scope that you just like, okay, I'm just going to keep doing the stuff where I put manure out.
Well, yeah. Not that. I think a lot of them are going to be like, you know, going to keep putting out the Miracle-Gro.
Oh, no.
And
if
the
if it says miracle on it, run.
So I just kind of feel like that's a very important thing. I mean, I know that in a previous podcast I've done the thing about the charity goodness, right?
Yes.
See,
yes.
So you know, so because you've listened to all my podcasts, you've heard my charity goodness speech.
Yes,
which is basically about the mycorrhiza. So. This is such an important leap, and this is where so much of, and so this next little part I've marked off goes on a little bit more detail about it. Many plants form symbiotic associations because of their inherent advantages. If a plant does not have access to its specific symbiotic partner, it will grow poorly. Frequently, poor soil or unfavorable climatic conditions are blamed, whereas it is usually enough just to incorporate a little soil from the plant's natural environment. The previously stunted plant will now thrive because it has access to its symbiotic partner. That, I mean,
yeah.
So this is where I kind of got one of the things that popped in my head. Like, let's say you've got a potato plant over there that's doing awesome and a potato plant over here that's sad. I wonder, you know, what if you just go and get a little soil from the good plant and dump it onto the plant that's sad?
That is, that's amazing.
I wonder what that might do. I wonder if that could be like the stuff.
Like the movie The Stuff? No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's, I had never heard that before, and yet it makes all the sense in the world. There's obviously something happening over here that isn't happening over there. And just take some of that over there and see if it'll, like, propagate and make things juicy.
It seems easy peasy. If nothing else, shouldn't hurt.
No.
I mean, it might hurt to go the other way.
Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe there's something over there that's keeping it from growing. It's not It's the other way around, right?
So yeah. So I don't know. It just seems cool and awesome, and you know, what an amazing thought. But all right. The next part I've got marked off. Mushroom cultivation does not require a large amount of space. It is possible to grow enough mushrooms for your own consumption on just 2 square meters of balcony. For farmers, mushroom cultivation can also make for a lucrative source of income with minimal costs and work. So I know that the last time I saw Sepp, he had Team Sepp with him. And while Sepp would spend part of the day hanging out in this massive room with all of us, and he stands in the front of the room and he conveys his knowledge to us, that in the meantime, Team Sepp is out seppifying land. And so then I remember we go out, and one day we're out, and there's the Team Sepp has created a demonstration of some things that can be done for urban permaculture. In fact, not just urban, but really micro urban. Like, you've got really just a balcony, and that's all you have. And so one of the solutions is that he had a wooden box that was probably about 2 feet high, and it was just full of soil. And inside of that soil, he put a couple rounds of wood, like probably 5 or 6 rounds of wood. I got pictures of it up at Permies. 5 or 6 rounds of wood, which he has inoculated with mushrooms. And, of course, then he's planted a bunch of other plants. So he's creating a polyculture within this box. And so then this whole thing, I mean, it seems like the favorite way that he has of the growing mushrooms is this whole idea of taking fresh green cut wood, inoculating it with mushroom spores, and then sticking it vertically into the ground so that a third of it is buried and 2/3 of it sticks up, and then you put these chunks of wood in the ground with the idea that these great big mushrooms are going to come out. So there's going to be room to be able to have them all come out. But then the other thing is, you don't want to space them too far apart, because they all kind of exude a certain level of humidity. And if you can optimize the humidity, so you're trying to find this optimal distance for each of them to be away from each other. But it's a very simple recipe. And so then all you got to do is just imagine how big the mushrooms are going to come out of this if they're really, really big for mushrooms.
Right.
And that they don't touch each other as they come out of these logs, and then you place the logs just that far apart from each other and no farther. And that's how you mentally place the logs. And then, of course, you know, a little bit of wetness kind of helps. But when they're green logs, like you just cut them an hour ago, then they're going to be full of moisture already.
Right, right. I mean, when you dry logs to burn in a fireplace, doesn't it take a year?
It depends. I mean, that would be a good podcast topic right there. Like, you know, burning wood. What does it take? Because I think a lot of people don't get it.
Right.
You know.
This is after it's been split. We're talking about logs that aren't even split. It's got to have moisture in it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you want logs that are, I mean, the logs that he prefers are probably about a good 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And then of course you drill little holes in them, like that are about half inch holes. And then you fill it with, I've marked off some of this stuff we're coming up to, but that's the primary way to. And then, of course, there's gobs of ways to grow fungus, and to grow mushrooms. And so it's like, this seems to be his favorite way, his most highly productive way for growing mushrooms. And it's just so incredibly simple. So and I know that for the event that's coming up, he'll be demonstrating it, because I know that the gal that's like running the show up there, Katarina, this was like one of the big topics. She wanted him to spend a full 2 days talking about growing your own mushrooms and funguses and things like that. Although to me, it's kind of like, I have a hard time imagining what you would talk about for a full 2 days.
But, well, you know, it, right, but with Sepp, you never know.
True.
I mean, the things that I thought were pretty cut and dry, I'm looking in here, and I know he's just basically skidding over his knowledge to get it in the book. And so I'm thinking there's got to be 1,000 more books in this man, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are, but then it's like when you start talking about huge books on the fungus, on the fungal stuff, mm-hmm. like even Paul Stamets' book is huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you start, it's like you kind of wander away from the practical a little bit. Or you'll have this massive book on 200 different species of mushrooms.
Right.
You know, which in itself, in many ways, is very important. Mm-hmm. However, it's kind of like, okay, we're going to grow like, you know, 8 different species of mushrooms, and we're probably going to inoculate with a few different species of funguses, you know, for this reason and that reason. And then at the same time, we're going to acknowledge that there's all kinds of mycorrhizal activity going on in the soil, which we want to encourage, you know, and then we're done, you know, is my perspective. But then, yeah, there are these people that, like, their whole lives are revolve around all the different species and all the different ups and downs and the, you know, the that aspect, that kind of thing, and they're very, very keen on that. And then, of course, there's Paul Stamets' book, Mycelium Learning, which goes into a lot of, like, here are some things that we should all know about funguses that you might not have known, and about how important they are to the symbiotic relationships of our world.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that's all good, but you know, when we're talking about being a homesteader or being a permaculturalist, I think, you know, there's a wildcrafting aspect that's good to know, and then here we're talking about planting them for income, and that's a good aspect to know too. But it seems like I would think that after a half a day workshop, it's covered very thoroughly.
You know, it would be covered enough for you to get started for sure, and probably even to go to market.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean he's talking about these specific kinds that are real easy to grow, you know. So, you know, it gets real crazy when you get into some of the, like, I hear maitake are really tough, and he goes into a few that are really tough. But these right. are the simple ones, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like this section of this book, this chapter of this book, isn't really huge, but it's like it cuts to the chase,
mm-hmm.
and then you're done. Right. And if you want to be more of a mushroom nut, you can.
Yeah.
But that's not what this book is about.
You know, right. I noticed he didn't point out that in the section that you shouldn't just go out into the woods and find things that look like mushrooms that are edible and eat them.
Yeah. That's good advice.
Yeah. Because, you know, that's not the way you do it.
All right, so health benefits. I mean, you know, Paul Stamets has done so much in this space, and of course, it's like it goes in the world of medicinal herbs, really, but it's medicinal mushrooms.
Right.
It has been scientifically confirmed that the shiitake mushroom has a positive effect in the treatment of cancer. And I mean, it goes on and on and on with all kinds of different things and all kinds of different. But of course, you know. And then here's a good point. The next section is the basics of mushroom cultivation, and this is something we've kind of talked about a little bit earlier. But I'm gonna here are Sepp's. Here's the paragraph of Sepp's right from Sepp's mouth. Only uncontaminated raw materials should be used to grow culinary and medicinal mushrooms. Mushrooms can absorb harmful substances and retain them. For this reason, you should be especially careful when using straw or compost as a substrate. If the straw or manure has been produced conventionally, it is, in my opinion, unsuitable for cultivating organic mushrooms. Even wood can contain harmful substances. Trees near busy roads, motorways, or industrial areas usually contain large amounts of heavy metals. These harmful substances accumulate in the bark and make the logs unusable for mushroom cultivation. Now, by unusable, I think what he means to say is, like, you shouldn't eat the mushrooms that come off of this. Because if a tree has toxic gick in it, that's like, and especially a heavy metal, something that isn't going to be able to be broken down by the mushroom into safe things, then the toxic gick is going to concentrate in the mushroom. So now a mushroom that is well known to be an edible or safe mushroom or a good mushroom or whatever is now going to become rather toxic.
Right.
And And so, because that's kind of part of what it does. That's how the mycoremediation thing works. It is just amazing how a mushroom will go into soil, find all those heavy metals, and pull them out and concentrate the heavy metals in the mushroom. And you never turn a shovel spade, you know. But now it's kind of like you've got this problem. Now this mushroom is full of these heavy metals and maybe some other toxic gick, and don't eat it. And it's kind of like, oh, now what do you do with it?
Right.
You know?
Well, that stuff ultimately will break down. It's just you have to take it somewhere else, and so that you can, you know, grow your own food in this area. You know, because, I mean, I've heard forever that you're not supposed to grow a garden within 1,000 feet of a very busy motorway because of the same reasons.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, yet you see farmers markets, and not farmers markets, but, you know, like farmer plots and big garden plots real close to very busy highways that are ancient, yeah. I mean, old highways that have just been going on forever. And I just think, man, that's got to be a mess.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'm glad. I am so glad because so often a lot of books about mushrooms or a lot of references about mushrooms just go into the four-color brochure of how awesome they are without revealing. And it's like, oh, it has these magical properties. It'll fix everything.
Right.
It fixes bad soil. And we leave out the part about, yeah, but don't eat it afterwards. And then it's like, oh, and whenever you find them, you can eat them because these are the edible variety.
Ooh.
But we left out the part of saying, like, unless, of course, it's, you know, sucking up toxic gick. And so it's like, I'm so, so very glad that Sep is, like, you know, pointing out not just the four-color brochure, but pointing out the ups and downs. I mean, this is a tool, and this is how the tool works. The tool works. The reason why it, you know, detoxifies the land is that all the toxin moves into the fruiting body there, and then you go and you get that, and it's like, yeah. So way to go, Sep. Good job.
Definitely.
He then goes into growing mushrooms on wood and his techniques, a lot of details, and then he goes into mushrooms for growing on wood, and then he goes in for each variety of mushroom, the different kinds of tricks, which kinds of woods to grow them on, a lot of awesome detail. Then in the section on substrate, I've marked off a part that says mushrooms colonize softwood much more quickly, which leads to an earlier yield. However, softwood logs also decompose more quickly, so the yield is much more short-lived. Cultures on softwood can grow through and give a yield in just 6 to 12 months. Hardwood usually requires twice that time, but the yield lasts substantially longer. In the long run, hardwood generally gives higher yields than softwood. So I think that this is an important point. And I think it's important to point out, too, softwood and hardwood, I think a good thing to keep in mind is there's a lot of deciduous species that are indeed softwoods. So as we're talking about, you know, softwood versus hardwood, let's keep in mind that just because it has broad leaves doesn't mean that it's a hardwood. Although I think all coniferous species are all softwoods. I'm not sure about that. There is, after all, one called the stone pine. maybe it got that name because it's a hardwood, but I don't know. I think all conifers are indeed softwoods.
I know he points out in here there's something called a stone something or other. I'm trying to find it now. That he says it's probably the least suitable of the hardwoods to grow on. So I guess if stone's in the title, run from it. You know, don't try to use it. You know.
Well, I think black locust would be a really bad idea.
Yeah, anything with black in the title.
Well, and so I think the other thing is, I think that conifer woods, it doesn't seem to me like people usually use conifers for growing mushrooms. I think it's always broadleaf, but, you know, I could be mistaken about that.
I use oak, and the oaks down here have little tiny, you know, little oaky leaves. So I don't know how that works out. I've never heard of the broadleaf thing being hardwoods. It's not my
word. Right.
Yeah.
Well, oak, of course, is a broadleaf and not a conifer.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. So what makes it a broadleaf? I don't want to get too far off the subject, but...
So an oak has... So a conifer is going to have, like, needles instead of leaves.
Oh, right. Right. Yes. And we have plenty of that.
Right. But then the thing is like, I just... Like I've never heard of anybody like intentionally saying, okay, I've gone and cut fresh wood off of this conifer tree and I want to use that to grow mushrooms in.
Nor have I.
I haven't heard anybody doing that. Mm-hmm. And so my impression has always been like that's not going to work out so well. And then there are woods like as a general wood, I think cottonwood or poplars would be really good woods, which is why they're really good woods for a hula culture bed too. But I think that they're going to be really good woods general for growing. So alder would be another good one.
Right.
So,
but you know, when I read this book, this little section, one of the things I take away from it is if you're going to get started with mushrooms, you want to get some softwoods, get those going, and get some hardwoods and get those going, and then you'll have in a short time something to sell, and then you'll have this long term thing, and then going forward, you know, as a plan, you would just stick to the hardwoods because it takes a long time to get these. I hear 2 years sometimes, unlike portobellos could take 2 years. It's a long time.
Right. Well, I'm going to say yes. That's an optimal path. Although I do think that for a lot of newbies, that could be. I mean, that kind of makes the job a little bit bigger. You know, I like the idea of people going out, setting this up, and then eventually works out. I don't know. I guess because it's multifaceted. Let's say that
right.
It's multifaceted. It's kind of like with composting. There's a lot of people that say, "Oh, if you're going to compost, you have to do it this way," which is a very complicated way. Don't forget to layer everything and stuff like that. And I just kind of want to say, "Nah, you know, if you just go out, if you want to compost, it can be incredibly easy. Like it could be see that guy over there and see all the stuff that he says you have to do." It can be 100 times easier than what that guy does, and it's still composting.
Right.
And so it's like, and I think there's a similar sort of a thing in here. And I think it's good to know about these different things. But it's like, boy, you don't have to read all the big books. I think what you got in here is really good. I mean, it's very much a how-to. And it's got really good pictures and really good simple ideas for all the how-tos. And it's just simply a chapter in the book, not this huge tome.
Right.
And it's like, this covers it. This gets it done for you. And when you're done, it's like it's going to tell you like these 10 different ways. And it's like, you know what? Just pick one mushroom, get the spore or get the stuff to do it. And then go and find a log that's the right kind of log and do the steps and you're done.
Right.
You're moving on. So
well, and there's information here that I haven't heard anywhere else that makes all the sense in the world and allows you to use logs that are kind of a little bit older. You know, a little bit older being like, you know, he's talking about you can use it within a year. I've always been told 2 weeks or, you know, a month. But, you know, if you've got logs, I'd say within 6 months or so, he shows you how you can actually take off the ends and do a few things. And so it's now safe to grow your mycelium, which is really cool.
You know what? I just had so we kind of go into the geeky stuff a little bit. And so 25 years ago, I got this project where I had to learn the C programming language. And so I went, I found these huge books on the C programming language, and it was confusing, and I didn't understand it. I just felt like I was stupid, and I didn't get it. And then there was this teeny tiny little book, which was called, you know, later I heard from all these people, it was called the K&R book because it's written by Kernighan and Ritchie, called the C Programming Language, and it's tiny. It's just a wisp of a book. But the thing is that you would read this little tiny wisp of a book, and these guys really knew what they were talking about, and suddenly, ding, it's all clear as a bell. Everything makes sense.
Yep.
And the writing style was brief and concise. And it's like, you know, you could read the whole book in like maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours, and you're done. And suddenly, just by reading this book, suddenly you are a C programmer. You can program in C. It's just that good.
Right.
And I kind of feel like what we're looking at here is an example of that. Here's a guy who really, 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 really knows what he's doing, and he's trying to reach out to those of us that are clods and saying the magic words, and suddenly, bing, we get it, and we're moving on. So, anyway, there. I said it. I think this is a very good, clear, concise chapter on how to raise mushrooms. It's awesome.
Awesome.
The next part I've got marked off. One of the most important factors for success when growing mushrooms in this way is using fresh and healthy wood. It must, under no circumstances, have been previously colonized by other fungi. They will displace the cultivated mushrooms and the crop will fail. This is why I use freshly cut wood whenever possible. It is also advisable to cut off a slice of wood from each end of the log before inoculation. Wait, it is also advisable. That's the word. I don't know why I said possible. This will reduce the danger of colonization by other fungi. Wood that has been stored for more than half a year is probably no longer suitable. The way I always think of it is that the living wood currently has no fungi of any kind like this in it while it's alive. It might have some endophytes or something like that, some kind of fungal thing going on inside, but that's a different kind of thing. But we're talking about a kind of fungi that's going to be more of a decomposer. And so, but once one kind of fungi has gotten in there, it's going to start setting up shop and take up all the parking spaces.
Right.
And then there's no room for anything else to move in. Well, and so then that's why you use fresh wood. If you use the fresh stuff, it's like totally open and ready for colonization.
Right. And it almost seems too that like in your area, the local native fungi or whatever's living here at the time has like, you know, bigger guns than the cultivated ones you're sticking in here. And so you have to make sure none of them are on this wood or they'll take over.
True. True. They are more they're more active. They're like some crazy wild stuff.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And they've already been to boot camp.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I know stuff's like, I'll just throw some mushrooms in here and let the wild ones get in here. We'll see who dukes it out and wins. Right.
yeah. So you're trying to you know take these guys that are kinder, gentler souls and giving them a head start. Mm-hmm. And once they're well established, then it'll kind of keep the wild stuff at bay.
Right.
Mushroom spawn. In order to inoculate the log, in other words, to introduce the fungus into the log, you will need healthy mushroom spawn. Earlier I said spores. I need to correct that to be spawn.
Right.
So spores are the little teeny tiny specks that fall out of the fruiting body.
Right.
Spawn is, okay, it says right here, mushroom spawn is nothing other than mycelium. Because mushrooms reproduce vegetatively, asexually, as a rule. Inoculation using spores, sexual reproduction, is rare because the probability of failure is too great. So so this is the common thing that is that usually you'll get like a little bit of sawdust or straw or something, and it's got this white stuff all over it, and that's like the that's the mycelium. That's what, because like whenever you see a mushroom, that's just the fruiting body of all the fungus that's underground. So there's this huge body of fungus underground, and this little tiny mushroom that pops up out of the ground, that is the fruiting body, the sexual body of the fungus. So that's just a tiny part of it. And so then what you do is you'll get this white stuff, this webby white stuff underground. That's the stuff that you're going to take pieces of and stick that into your fresh cut wood that's going to then colonize that wood. Propagating spawn yourself. And so then the last time I saw SEP and Team SEP, they were propagating a whole bunch of mycelium themselves. You can create and propagate mushroom spawn yourself with a little practice. It's really pretty easy, and it's just a matter of just sitting down and doing it a few times, and you might stumble a couple of times, but big deal. It's easy. It's a piece of cake.
I'm really happy that section is in the book, too, because, you know, as a homesteader, you can't just keep running off the property going and buying, you know, spawn from somewhere. I mean, to me, the idea is to be self-contained. So if you can learn how to make your own spawn, keep propagating it, moving it forward, that's a beautiful thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So he's got a huge section creating and maintaining the culture. And I don't know if you've got any of this stuff marked up, but I'm on to page 148 now.
This is my wife's book, so I don't mark it up, but I've taken notes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I wanted to ask you, have you done mushrooms yourself?
I've only done a little bit of it. I mean, I've done some wild crafting of mushrooms, and morels are awesome. And when I grew up as a kid, getting morels was a big thing. And I got to tell you, I'm awful at it. I will find one or two morels, and then my cousin will come up behind me and will, you know, like, fill a bag. Like, you just walk past all these.
Yeah. Lucky.
Damn it.
Lucky
or,
people.
I've been out with people, and it's like, you know, I'll look at this area. There are no mushrooms in this area.
You're too busy thinking about things.
Well, I don't know about that. I think I'm just stupid. I don't have the eye. I don't know what it is. I'm defective this way.
Right.
And then, you know, the other person will be like, what do you mean you don't? What do you mean there's nothing here? Look, right there, right there. And I still don't see it.
Wow.
And then they're like, almost have to stand on it, and their fingers almost touching it before I go, oh, there it is. It like just appeared. And so, like, whoa, I don't know. There's something wrong with me.
Well, that's true.
thanks for your support.
Well, it's actually a good thing, I think. But, hey, whenever I read about the, you know, inoculating of logs and spores, using the not spores, but spawn plugs and things like that, they always tell you to put, like, a beeswax around the end and over each one of the holes that you've made. But in here, he doesn't do that. And I was wondering if you'd had any, because I'd much rather not use beeswax if it's not necessary.
Yeah, I would have to say, I think the reason why they're doing it is to keep other things from picking it out, or other funguses coming along and trying to set up shop there or whatever. But
right.
I haven't done it. I don't use beeswax.
Okay.
But I haven't done it very often. And when I saw Sep do it, he wasn't doing anything like that then,
right,
either.
He just sticks a piece of wood in.
It might be one of those things where in one of the pictures that I saw in here, it did seem like there was some stuff where things are being covered up. So he's got this one where he's got this notched log technique that he does with a chainsaw.
Right.
And then he covers that with a piece of paper.
That one, yeah.
And he staples it. And I think the thing, my guess is, and I've not done it, because I just kind of figured, like, yeah, you go along and you do this, and it's like, good luck, you're on your own, I'll see you in a year. And I think that you get better success rate, like a higher success rate. You go from like 70% success rate to possibly 90% success rate.
Gotcha.
If you do things like that. And to me, I kind of think like, but that seems like a lot of extra work.
Right.
You know, like the return on effort really isn't there.
Yeah. Is it really worth the work? Yeah, I gotcha. Okay.
That's my general feeling, and I could be and further, I like things to be simpler. Like I like there to be fewer steps. It's kind of like when you compost, you have to do all these things. It has to be layered. You have to have this layer contain these kinds of things, and this layer is manures, and this layer is straw, and this layer is something else. And it's kind of like I far prefer the idea of like, oh, you just take any kind of organic matter and you throw it in a pile. And if it starts to smell funny, put some more sawdust on it. That's it.
Right. No, I agree. Otherwise, you know, when you're trying to get other people to kind of get on board with a program, if it's too busy, too complicated, it's not going to happen. So when it's real simple, yeah, then you start getting a little cooperation. And these are the things. And also for myself, I cannot get involved with these things if they're too complicated. So the simpler they are, the better. And this is why I was wondering about that. There's always like 5 or 10 things you have to get together, and these things have to come together to do mushrooms. Well, if all you had to do is drill a hole and stick the plugs in, that's a whole lot easier. So.
Yeah, I think it can be really easy. And at the same time, I mean, you do want to ensure some level of success.
Right.
And it's like, I mean, I think there's a big difference between 10% success rate and, you know, 70% success rate. So it's like, you know, but if you've got a system that's going to give you a 70% success rate, which is the thing where you use fresh logs, mm-hmm. so freshly cut logs from a tree that was growing there an hour ago, you know, use that wood, and then combined with the thing where you stick it in the soil, you know, you stick it 1/3 into the soil, and then, you know, you space them just right. I mean, this is a recipe, but it's not the only recipe. But it's like, okay, so this recipe gives you like a good 70% success rate as is, and it's like so now if we did something where it's like, okay, we just found a log and we drilled a hole in it, put the spawn in there, and then left the log there, and it was already colonized and whatnot, that, you know, now we're talking about 10% success rate. So being able to come up with a system that gives you 9 times better results, I think that's worth considering.
Yeah.
And then when you got something that's like, okay, now we're going to give you 10% better results. Well, let's see. We got, on the one hand, we got 900% better.
Right.
And on the other hand, we got 10% better. And it's kind of like, okay, you know, let's talk about the 900% thing first.
Right.
And you know what? We can just skip over the 10% thing. So after you've done it 2 or 3 years, you might start talking about the 10% thing and whether it's worth it or not. As opposed to saying, this is a required ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
You can't succeed unless you do this.
It's good business practice, yeah.
All right, the last part I've got marked off for today's podcast is under the tips section. If, after a few years, there has still not been a crop and the mycelium has not grown through well, this means that the conditions for fruiting body growth are not optimal. Dormant logs can, however, be activated by soaking them for a few hours and striking them with a mallet or rock. The moisture and the shaking stimulate fruiting body growth. This method generally has the desired effect. I discovered this phenomenon when I first began to cultivate mushrooms, and some of my cultures were not successful. After waiting for a while, I decided to dispose of them. I took what I supposed to be useless logs on my tractor to one of the wetlands and tipped them all in the shallow water near the bank. I wanted the logs to at least provide hiding places for young fish and crayfish. They also made the shallows of the wetland more attractive. When I came back to the microclimate after a few weeks, almost all of the logs were covered in oyster mushrooms. I could scarcely believe my eyes and tried to find the reason for the resurrection of my cultures. What happened? The logs were most likely dormant from lack of moisture. The bumpy ride on the tractor and being tipped into the pond not only shook them thoroughly, but also saturated them with water. In addition, the hollow around the wetland is naturally much more humid as a result of evaporation. All of these factors worked together and led to this unexpected success. All right, I think a couple of other quick points is that wherever you're going to do this, try and do your mushroom stuff in a place where you're not going to have a lot of wind. If there's a location on your property that's going to have less wind than others, I'd say, because that's humidity is an important ingredient. Humidity plus wood, really.
Right.
I mean, there are people in Seattle get funguses, all kinds of mushrooms and things to grow in their closets.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, like, not intentionally.
Oh, like in your laundry hamper.
Well, actually, in Florida, you probably, know some folks. Because I've been to Florida twice, and it's like, you get off the plane, and it's like, do you expect us to breathe this air?
Oh, I know.
It's so heavy.
Yeah,
it's
well,
so humid.
Certain times of the year, and those are the times of year I can't stand. But yes. Yeah, it's like take a slice of air, you know?
Yeah, and then talk about morning dew. You get up in your car, and it's like it's amazing how the morning dew finds a way to get as much water as possible to stay on the car. It's like it's just covered in puddles of water, and it's like, how does and you kind of, it's this little lesson in how water loves itself, and
right,
and you know, this weird beading thing, like how do the beads possibly get any bigger? How can you possibly, you can't possibly add more dew to this car? car.
Well, this is one of the things that's nice, because you do get that dew in the morning. Whether it rains for months, you will get dew in the morning a lot of times, and that is watering your garden.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely.
So it gets warm.
And so like in Seattle, there's a lot of people that move away from Seattle because it's like the whole mushrooms growing in the closet thing is just gotten to be too much.
Oh, wow.
And you get mold around the windows. And so in Seattle, the thing to do is you open your windows just this little tiny eighth of an inch, and you just kind of leave them that way all the time. So that way air can get in there, and it keeps the mold out.
Right.
And you just need a little better air circulation.
I'm sure that happens here, but I haven't really seen, you know, lots of mold. But it would have to happen in a place where you're allowing a lot of darkness and humidity to hang out. Because I do know that some people will turn, like, 100-watt light bulbs into an area, and it keeps the mold away.
Right, right. True. Radiant heat.
Yeah.
Radiant heat. And it dries it out. Helps to dry it out. Helps to it lowers the amount of humidity. Lowers the humidity. So
that only works with incandescents, by the way.
Yeah. Incandescents are so awesome.
Yeah.
I think so the key is that molds are a type of fungus, and they are, so it's kind of like thus proving here's an area where fungus would do well, so still air is good. Fungus likes still air, and fungus doesn't need any light. Although I think it does do better. A lot of funguses do much better when they can interact with plants that can get to light, because then they're doing the photosynthesis thing and creating sugar, and so then that's how the funguses can get the sugar, which they crave. But for the most part, they'll do fine. They'll take dead material and convert it into what they need in order to live, and they'll find it in your closets in Seattle.
Right. Where are my socks?
Yeah, they're your socks. Your all cotton, all natural socks are now home to some mushrooms.
Yeah.
So my only point was is where the wind blows, wind tends to be very desiccating, very drying,
right,
which is why when you hang your laundry out to dry, you know, wind is what does most of the drying. Some people say, oh, I want to hang it out in the sun. And it's like, yeah, the sun helps, but it's not that much. Really, it's the wind. It's the breeze.
Wow.
Is
well,
what dries your clothes.
The sun in Florida, yeah, it's really hot. It's evaporating. I mean, you can throw something – like if I had a wet T-shirt and I throw it over a line or a fence without any wind, it will be dry in 10 minutes.
That was the other thing that you and I were going to talk about into a podcast. You and I were going to make a podcast about how to cool your home.
Oh, yeah, because that's a big deal here.
You know, the permaculture way.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm working on right now.
All right. We'll have to do a podcast about that soon.
Yes.
All right. Anything else about this section? We're not done with the chapter. You know, we've got like another 10 pages or so to go for this chapter. Yeah.
Yep.
And so that'll probably be the podcast for tomorrow.
All right.
But got anything else to say about what we've read so far?
It's freaking awesome.
If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com. where we have a whole forum dedicated to fungus, which used to be called Fungi Perfecti, but now it's just called Fungi. Homesteading and permaculture all the time.